You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Peter Asher returns to the show this week. He's a musician, Grammy-winning record producer, manager, and author, most recently of The Beatles From A to Z, an alphabetical mystery tour. He was Peter in Peter and Gordon, and he's back to continue our discussion from a few weeks back, and I'm so grateful. Peter Asher, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
I saw you on Late Night with Stephen Colbert the other night, performing with Steve Martin.
Oh, right, yes. That's a track I'd produced with Steve and the Steep Canyon Rangers, a brilliant bluegrass band with whom he works. And I'd played some percussion parts and stuff on the record, so when we did it live, I was there doing the same thing.
Well, the show was taped at the Ed Sullivan Theater. Did that bring back any memories of Peter?
That's right. I mean, to be honest, in a practical way, not really, because it just doesn't seem like the same place. I don't remember Ed Sullivan that well, but I guess I remember the outside, and that rings a bell. But the inside is so completely different, and there's no Ed Sullivan. But certainly people, it mostly reminded me because everyone would kept saying, "Oh, of course you were here in 65 or whatever it was in the Ed Sullivan show," and I went, "Yes." Indeed, I was.
Were there screaming? You don't recall the performance on Ed Sullivan?
Well, I recall doing it, and I mean, it was fun doing it because it was one of the few television shows where you got to sing live. You know, it wasn't lip sync, so we were singing with the Ed Sullivan Orchestra, who were very good, and so I remember that, and of course there's a video of it, so I remember it now because I see it from time to time.
Before Peter and Gordon, you'd been on television a lot. You were an actor on television.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about that. You were in a show with Boris Karloff.
Among other things, I was. It's funny how people are very interested in that one. I started off in films, actually. My first film I did when I was 8, where my father was played by Jack Hawkins, a very distinguished British actor. You might know from Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia and all those kinds of military films. But my mother, more excitingly, was played by Claudette Colbert, the extraordinary American actress who at that time was working in London. So that was my very first film. And I think my first television was probably the old Robin Hood series with Richard Green, the one that was on in America that was quite successful here. So that did make it across the Atlantic. But yes, among other things, Boris Karloff ended up in London doing a detective series called Colonel March. And of course, I didn't know anything about Boris Karloff because I was 10 or whatever, and his series, I mean, the majority of his work were kind of horror movies that I was too young to see. You know, they were all what they in England they call X-rated, which doesn't mean pornographic, it means no children in general. So I didn't really know much about, you know, people say, wasn't it scary working with Boris Karloff? And I said, no, he was charming. And I wasn't aware of his alter ego as some kind of monstrous person.
Well, I've read that he was a very nice
He seemed very nice. He was nice to me. And I remember there was one scene where he had to smash a glass of milk that he realized had been poisoned out of my hand before I drank it. And he was concerned that would be scary. But, of course, he did it with a stunt arm holding some other person holding the glass of milk when it actually got smashed. But he expressed concern over my well-being. He was charming.
So Boris Karloff saved your life, then?
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. I wouldn't be where I am today without Boris Karloff.
And so you really came from all of your siblings were actors, too.
Yeah, Jane and Claire and I, my two sisters and I, all got signed up by an acting agent at the same time. I think we all three got signed. I imagine that she, the agent who signed us, thought we would end up working together because there were three of us graded in height and all with bright red hair that she probably saw some kind of, I would imagine, commercial possibilities in or something. But we ended up all doing bits and pieces of acting and Claire took it, was the least into it, my younger sister. She ended up being the sort of academic of the family. And Jane, of course, took it extremely seriously and built an incredibly successful career, which continues to this day. And I loved acting, and I still occasionally get to do it. If I can talk a friend into giving me a part in something, I'll take it.
And as we were talking about last time, your sister Jane was, of course, Paul McCartney's girlfriend, and then Paul McCartney lived in your house and all. Was it awkward for you when Paul McCartney and Jane Asher broke up?
No. You know, I think we're English. We don't talk about these things. We just carry on, you know. I don't remember any particular discomfort. No, Paul and I continued to work together.
Are you still friends with Paul McCartney, by the way?
Every now and then. I mean, it's one of those things where you run into somebody and embrace and talk about getting together, and then you don't because you're both running around the world. You know? So I don't see much of him, but occasionally I do. I certainly would count him as a friend, yes.
And Jane Asher, of course, as you mentioned, she's still performing. She has a whole food thing that she's doing.
Well, she did have a cake company, but that turned out to be a giant headache after a while, so she gave that up. But she's highly regarded for her skills in those areas. Yeah, she's had cooking magazines and all that kind of stuff. I mean, she was described at one point as Britain's answer to Martha Stewart, you know. But she hasn't been to prison, so she hasn't fulfilled the profile exactly. But she works all the time acting mostly.
But she still looks incredibly beautiful. She looks great.
Yes, clearly runs in the family.
Oh, you look great too. I saw you on TV.
Well, thank you very much. I fished for that one.
But you're perfect for radio, Peter Asher.
Well, thanks. Yes, I enjoy doing the radio show. But, yeah, as I say, I still enjoy acting whenever the opportunity arises.
So I want to ask you a little bit about your life as a record producer, but I have a couple of questions about your recording career first. Last time we talked, I was telling you that I had seen you perform with Jeremy Clyde at a benefit concert at the Troubadour in Los Angeles that Phil Oakes was putting on.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you were friends with Phil Oakes, and I know that you recorded A Flower Lady, which is one of my favorite Phil Oakes songs.
Indeed.
And our listeners may not remember that Phil Oakes was a great singer-songwriter who came out of, along with Bob Dylan, came out of New York as a protest singer.
Yep.
And how did you meet him, and did you know him when you recorded Flower Lady?
Yes. Oh, yes. I met Phil quite early on in New York, I think probably through my then wife, who I think knew him, or sort of knew the people on that folk scene. And I liked Phil very much, you know, and I knew him, you know, stayed friends with him the whole time, even when unfortunately he went very nuts at the end, you know, and he had this all alter ego and went crazy. It was all very depressing. But he's immensely talented. I mean, people forget now that it was all about, you know, who's going to make it out of the folk scene into the big time. And, you know, there was actually, the betting was kind of on Phil over Bob Dylan, because Phil was the handsome one. And they both wrote great songs. But I think Dylan was more determined to be a giant star, which he became, and make himself deliberately a little bit enigmatic. But, you know, the people like them and Dave Van Ronk was a big deal, and there was a lot of good musicians and writers coming out of that scene. And I really liked Phil very much. And Phil was a big pop fan, of course, too. You know, let's not forget he did that album cover in the gold lamé Elvis suit and everything.
He, 50 Phil Oakes
he was a big Elvis fan. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he liked pop music as well. He was delighted when we did his song. And we put it on the B-side of a hit. I think it might have been Lady Godiva or something. But I know it was a B-side of a successful single, which helped him out, of course.
Yeah, he made some money on that one.
Yep. Oh. Yep. He did.
Well, let's hear it. This is The Flower Lady, written by Phil Oakes and performed by my guest, Peter Asher, as part of the team Peter and Gordon.
Millionaires and paupers walk the lonely street. Rich and poor companions of the restless feet. Strangers in a foreign land, strike a match with a trembling hand. Learn too much to ever understand. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady. agonize, they cannot find the words. Stone stares at the sculptor, says, are you absurd? Painter paints his brushes black. Through the canvas runs a crack. Portrait of the pain never answers back. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady. About the present using memories. Never found their pot of gold. Wrinkled hands found weary holes. Each line screams out, you're old, you're old, you're old. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower. Hobbles home without a sail. Tattered shreds of petals leave a fading trail. Not a pause to hold a rose. Even she no longer knows. The lamp goes out, the evening now is closed. But nobody's buying flowers from the flower lady.
That was Flower Lady by Phil Oakes, performed by Peter and Gordon. Phil Oakes was a wonderful songwriter. If he'd lived, I think he would have experienced a revival of his career, for sure.
Definitely. Well, they kept talking about making the Phil Oakes movie, which would have been very good, actually, because it would have been a center for a description, a movie about the whole of New York in that period and the whole folk boom and everything. I mean, Dylan would have been in it, but instead of making a Dylan movie, it would have been that whole scene. And I know that ideas and various scripts have been bounced around. Sean Penn, at one point, some years ago, wanted to make that movie and play Phil himself, which he would have been perfect for. But I guess now he's too old to play that Phil of that era. But I agree with you. I think Phil will enjoy some kind of revival, and people realize he was a very significant part of that scene. And there's a tape of him doing a Beatles song too. I'm trying to remember. It's out there on the internet. Phil and somebody else, I've forgotten who, doing I Should Have Known Better, and which at the time was, it's live in a folk club, and the audience, you can tell, was totally divided about, you know, because Phil talks about how he thinks they're brilliant songwriters and this is a terrific song, and you can hear the audience kind of mumbling, oh, you know, this is supposed to be a serious, folky, left-wing club, you know, and why are they playing this silly pop song? And then by the end, another half of the audience is going, that was great, what a great song. So it's very interesting. He didn't see the separation between pop music and folk music at all. And, of course, he was ahead of his time in that regard.
Yes, when he did that album, Gunfight at Carnegie Hall, where he does his Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley medleys and people are booing.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. He loved all the same people I love, you know. Buddy Holly and Elvis and the Everlys. He was a big fan, you know, all that stuff. And became immediately a Beatles fan. He got how good they were right away.
People are maybe less snobby about music now, but I don't know if they are or not.
Yeah, I think in some respects they are, but you still get people. I mean, you get weird, like some of the people in electronic music are very snobby, you know. I always find if there's some kind of electronic or EDM piece that I particularly like, usually the people who are into that kind of music go, oh, no, that's not good. You know, that's got a hook. They like the ones that just, to me, seem to drone on a bit without much changing. So, I mean, I think everybody who's into their own field of music has the ability to get snobby about it and snooty, but I think it's less. You're right. And certainly the overall gap between classical and pop has diminished massively. Classical music used to look down its nose at pop music and does not at all, and vice versa. Pop music used to be scared of classical music, and that's really changed a lot. You know, you get a lot of great classical musicians who are just as interested in all kinds of modern music as well.
Well, I remember when Rubber Soul came out, and I asked my father to just sit for just a minute and just listen to this one song.
Mm-hmm.
And I played him, you know, I think it was I'm Looking Through You.
Uh-huh.
And my father said, it sounds just like all their other records, which it clearly didn't.
No, exactly. No, it's preconceptions.
Yeah. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking today with Peter Asher. He's the famous record producer, musician, the Peter of Peter and Gordon, and the author of The Beatles, A to Z. One of the reasons I was asking you about Phil Oakes is when Phil Oakes moved from Elektra to A&M Records, he started to produce his music more than just have it be his acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
And the production of his records was very elaborate, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of the production that you did on the first James Taylor album. So I was wondering, you know, we talked about your musical influences, but what about your production influences? How did you become a producer, and what producers influenced you?
Well, I wanted to be a producer the minute I was first in the studio. Once I realized what a producer did and could do, that you could try out arrangement ideas and sonic ideas and that kind of stuff, I thought that was great. And hire musicians much better than yourself and tell them what to do. I thought the whole plan was brilliant. So that was a very conscious decision on my part to get into production. I was influenced by every record I listened to. Which meant mostly, of course, American records at the time. Rock and roll records and Everly Brothers records and Elvis records and R&B records and Stax records and Motown records. So, I mean, they all played a role, and there were elements of all those things that I would try to emulate. But, and been also, of course, I'd been influenced already by classical music that I'd grown up surrounded by and so on. So, if anything, that first James Taylor album, I think I tried to cram too many influences into it. I mean, I was so anxious that people take James seriously and think, not just think, oh, it's another long-haired folky singing, you know, self-pitying songs with his acoustic guitar. And so I think, in retrospect, I may have overdone it a bit in terms of, let's put a string chord head here and some horns here and a drum break here and this, that, and the other. And I think I learned from that, you know, as James has pointed out, you know, we were learning together. That was the first album he'd ever made and the first album I'd ever produced in full. I'd done some tracks before, but not a whole album. So I think, and by the time we moved to America and did the next album, which was Sweet Baby James, I'd learned a lot. But my influences were manifold, and I would always look and see who produced those records, but just like songwriters, they were just names to me. You know, I didn't know who, you know, in the case of Motown producers, I don't think were even always listed. And I didn't know much about the people who were making those records. I just loved them, what they did.
Well, when you made the Sweet Baby James album, for instance, that album feels like it's an acoustic record because you have James's guitar and voice up front. But like on the track Sweet Baby James, you've got all kinds of musicians playing on that record.
Well, I guess there's Carol and I forget who played bass on that track. I used several different bass players. But the whole album has Carol and Cooch and Russ Kunkel. playing and various different bass players. And then on Sweet Baby James, the track, there's Red Rose playing steel as well, as I recall.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So you kind of evolved your... were your tastes changing, or you were just seeing this would be the best thing for James?
The latter. My tastes were always fairly Catholic and inclusive. And I was just trying to frame the songs in a less intrusive way than perhaps I had on the first album.
There is a young cowboy who lives on the range. His horse and his cattle are his only companions. He works in the saddle and he sleeps in the canyons, waiting for summer, his pastures to change. And as the moon rises, he sits by his fire, thinking about women and glasses of beer, and closing his eyes as the dogies retire. He sings out a song which is soft but it's clear, as if maybe someone could hear. Good night, you moonlight ladies, rock-a-bye, sweet baby Jane. Deep greens and blues are the colors I choose. Won't you let me go down in my dreams and rock-a-bye, sweet baby James.
I had been a fan of 10,000 Maniacs. I heard their first record when it came out. I believe Joe Boyd produced that record.
Yeah.
Who had produced the Fairport Convention? It might have been what got my attention.
Yeah, no, Joe's great. He managed the incredible string band for ages.
Right. Oh, I love, yeah. Of course, that I love those guys. And then the record that you did, that was their second album, In My Tribe. And, I mean, the sound became so much fuller. How did you, first of all, how did you get involved with them, and how did you approach making that record?
I was involved by the A&R guy at Elektra, Howard something. Very good guy, and I've forgotten his second name. I'm sure you can look it up. But I think it was his suggestion, I believe. And I know Natalie, on behalf of the band, met with several producers, and I mean, the funny part is that even then I was like the more established older guy compared to, you know, some of the, you know, new young producers, and which seems incredible now 100 years ago, but Natalie and I hit it off, you know, and I explained to her, you know, what I thought, how I thought the album should be a bit different than the ones they'd made before, which was essentially issues of clarity. You know, I really like arrangements that are pretty organized and clear and leave space. And when somebody plays something, it's because it's needed and it's because it's a part. And you know, so things get a bit less noodly and a bit more precise. And in particular, I wanted her vocal to shine in a way that I didn't think it had on the previous records, which was both a technical question. I tried a million different microphones before I decided exactly how to record her vocal, and the way I mixed it, and the kind of compression I used and stuff, just to make sure that her vocal and her lyrics were the center of things, which I felt on the other albums they weren't quite so successfully. And worked with the band. You know, we did a lot of pre-production, just in rehearsal, working out parts and stuff, and then, you know, when they came to the guitar solos and things, I would leave those till we'd done the track and work on the solo pretty much note by note with Rob, which irritated him a bit sometimes. He got pissed off occasionally that I was being too authoritarian about the solos. But as you'll notice, the solos on that record are like in a Beatle record. The solo is not just somebody taking off and improvising a solo. They are parts, you know, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, and so would those parts be written out, or they just
no.
learn them?
Yeah. Worked out. Yeah. You know, it's usually me sitting next to the guitar player, same as, you know, all the brilliant work that Andrew Gold did, you know, on Linda's records. You know, Andrew was a genius, but essentially that consisted of him and I sitting next to each other at the board, piecing the thing together note by note till we knew exactly what we wanted. And sometimes you know, piecing it together in pieces, and sometimes just assembling the part as a part, not written down, but so that then we do a take of the whole thing, so it sounded real and live, but we had the notes figured out. So, yeah, I like putting a little thought into those kind of things.
Here are 10,000 Maniacs performing their song Like the Weather, produced by Peter Asher in 1987. That was 10,000 Maniacs, produced by my guest, Peter Asher. Peter Asher, we were talking about Andrew Gold, who played so brilliantly on many of your hits with Linda Ronstadt. How did it come to be that Andrew Gold became a solo performer? He had been a session guy, and did you see that in him?
I don't remember, to be quite honest with you. I mean, he obviously wanted to make his own record, and Elektra must have said yes, I can only assume. I don't remember a moment of... you know, of how that happened. I think it was clear to all of us that Andrew should make his own record because he was a brilliant singer and writer and everything. And so And he asked me to do it. That's where Lonely Boy came from, and the album that was on.
That was a pretty big hit.
Yeah, it was.
Let's talk a little bit about Linda Ronstadt. We mentioned the movie that The Sound of My Voice, which is such a great film, and it's nice that you're a big part of the film. But how did you become involved with her?
Linda, I was in New York, and somebody said, you have to go down to the Bitter End and see this girl. She's incredible. They said, she's got the most amazing voice you've ever heard, you know, and she goes on stage barefoot in very short shorts and looks amazing, and, you know, and it was all true. And so I went down and met her afterwards, and also discovered, which I continue to discover this day, how incredibly well-read and intelligent and brilliant she is on top of all that. So we began working together. I think I started working sort of as a producer first, I think, only because she was in the middle of trying to finish that album, Don't Cry Now, which had got a bit muddled. She'd worked with various producers on various tracks, and it just needed a bit of sorting out and pulling together, and a couple more tracks finished. And I undertook that task. And then during that time, it also became clear she was leaving her current manager, Herbie Cohen, and was looking for a manager. So she asked me if I would be interested in managing her as well, which I was delighted to do. So I became a manager as well. And then by the time the next album came around, we decided that I would produce it, you know, entirely from beginning to end.
And that was Hunt Like a
Wheel.
Yeah, what a fantastic record that was.
Thank you.
One of the things I learned about her from the film, and I'd read her autobiography, but somehow the film brought it out more, is the way that she goes from one thing to the next is in no way random. She's a very determined artist.
Right, so. And also the other thing that one cannot overemphasize is people are saying, you know, why are you moving into this whole new area, and why don't you go back to the real Linda that we know and love? And of course, that was complete nonsense, because actually, the real Linda, in many ways, was the mariachi Linda, because those are indeed the songs she learned on her father's knee, as the title would indicate. You know, she never ventured into any area that she hadn't been singing for her whole life, which was to say, both the rancheras and the American standards and all, you know, all that stuff. None of it was like, let me leap into unknown territory, but more like, let me sing these songs I've always loved and always wanted to sing.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro on KSCO. My guest this week is Peter Asher. He's a record producer. He's the Peter of Peter and Gordon, and he's the author of The Beatles, A to Z. Well, when the Beatles, you know, the kind of one of the most amazing things about the Beatles, as you well know, is this crazy. It all happened so quickly in this 8-year period, and the arc of their music, the way their music evolved from one kind of thing to another. They never repeated what they had already done. They were always reaching for something new. Did anybody ever give them a hard time and say, why don't you do She Loves You?
I don't know, actually. I don't remember that, but I would imagine, I'm sure, I have no doubt that when, you know, there was some tracks that, you know, when Brian or whoever first played them with the record company, I can well imagine them being going, oh, couldn't we please have another, please me, you know, instead of all this weird stuff. I can imagine someone saying that, and I bet they did. But you know, Brian would have stuck up for them, you know, in an extraordinary and persistent and informed and way, and would have won the day. Besides, at that point, they'd become the Beatles, and they could win.
Well, so you produced albums for various artists at various record labels. Did you ever find that one label was more would pressure you more? Can't we have the same kind of record again?
No, I mean, no, not one by label, but I mean, of course, Linda making those radical moves did cause conniptions over it. You know, Joe Smith, who was a great guy, he died recently and greatly missed. He was a terrific guy, but he was disconcerted by the idea of doing the Nelson Riddle albums or the idea of doing the mariachi albums, no question about it. You know, because his job is to sell records and deliver great numbers to the parent company for that quarter, and he could see those great numbers flying away. Turns out he was wrong, but then so was I. I supported Linda utterly. My job was to get the record she wanted to make made, but did I think the Nelson Riddle album was going to sell like five times as many as her preceding rock and roll album, which it did? No, I certainly didn't.
Well,
she amazed me.
Well, as the manager of some of these artists, so you're James Taylor's manager in those days as well, correct?
Yes.
And
yes.
So he moved famously from Warner Brothers to Columbia.
Yes.
And do you think his albums changed? Do you think the sound of his records changed? Or could Flag have been done at Warner Brothers?
Oh, because of the label? No, the label doesn't make any difference at all. Because you can make the record wherever you want with whoever you want for whichever label it is. So, no, I don't think there was no label influence and no difference. I mean, the album was different because, you know, producers changed, you know, studios changed, places changed, wives changed, whatever. But the label, I think, is irrelevant. The label job comes in when the record comes out, you know.
Do you have recording studios that you prefer to work in that have different sounds that other studios do?
Yes, I have some favorite studios, but I can work anywhere. But yes, I mean, I like Abbey Road, I like Air Studios in London, I like Conway in L.A., the studios that I've always enjoyed working in. But these days, the studios that you used to book for, you know, 2 or 3 months, you book for like 2 days, and then the rest of the time you work in some hovel with the engineer, you know, it's in the engineer's attic or whatever, you know, and which is fine. But I like certain studios in the same way I like certain bits of equipment or whatever, but I think the engineer is more important than the studio in the end.
You're like Brian Wilson wants to record this bit at that studio and then bring everybody to a different studio for some other bit. That's not you.
Yeah. Well, it's nice if you can do that, you know, but I think it's a little over the top.
Peter Escher, you're a CBE, you have a CBE. Well, how do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us about that? What did you have to kneel in front of?
No, you don't actually kneel until you get your knighthood, which is different. You step forward. You know, they give you a little rehearsal before. You know, there's a line of people approaching in Buckingham Palace, waiting in line in front of whatever member of the royal family has been designated by the Queen on this occasion. You know, the awards all officially come from the Queen. As they charmingly describe her, she is the fountain of all honor, a phrase I really like. But they're actually given out by any member of the royal family. Mine was Prince William. You step forward and you bow your head and he speaks to you for a few minutes and then puts this thing around your neck and off you go.
Well, did you consider it a great honor, or it was like, oh, I have to go to Buckingham Palace today?
Oh, no. It was a great honor. I was very excited. You know, because when they tell you, it's like super secret. You know, I got a phone call from the British Consul General's office here in Los Angeles, and they say, you know, are you alone? I went, what? Can you speak freely? Then, you know, Her Majesty has decided to offer you to make you a commander of the British Empire, give you a CBE, and would you accept? You know, I went, yes, you know. Of course, some people turn it down on principle. Supposedly David Bowie did, but I know a number of people who have. On the grounds that the British Empire is not that virtuous a historical organization to which they want to be connected. But as far as I'm concerned, I was an absolutely yes, count me in. And so, it was very exciting. And it was, no, if I didn't take it seriously, I wouldn't. I mean, of course, it isn't serious in the sense that do you get anything other than a very nice piece of bling and a handshake? No. But is it a big deal if you're English? I think so.
Have you met the Queen ever?
I met the Queen for one second. She came to our school. You know, Westminster School, where I went, has a particular association with the royal family. And she did walk down the line and nod to me. I don't think we even shook hands at the time. She was... But Westminster School has an association via Westminster Abbey with the monarchy, and she did make some kind of visit while I was there. But meeting her properly, no.
You think she's a Peter and Gordon fan? She puts on Lady Godiva from time to time?
I would love to think so.
It's good. It's good music. I love these Peter and Gordon albums. I've always loved them.
Thank you.
Gordon Waller passed away in 2009, I believe. But you had eventually reformed your duo and played together?
Yes, we got back together at the instigation of Paul Schaefer for a benefit in New York. He was doing a benefit for Mike Smith of the Dave Clark Five, who needed some help. And They were fellow keyboard players and friends, and so Paul Shaffer decided to do a British Invasion themed benefit at B.B. King's in New York, and it was actually his wife, Kathy, who said to him, you know, what would be great would be if you get Peter and Gordon back together, because they haven't sung together for 27 years, 37 years, whatever it was, I can't remember now, 37, I think. And he called me up, and I kind of went, maybe this is the time we should do a couple of songs and see what happens. And because, you know, I knew he'd obviously put an incredibly good band together, which he did. And the thing would be, and Paul and Gordon was very friendly with Mike Smith as well, so it all made sense. So I called Gordon and we said yes. And because that worked, and people liked it, we didn't sound awful or anything, and we took some time to obviously make sure we could still sound like ourselves. And so that's why we decided if there's other gigs out there and to fit in with what I was doing at the time, because I was very busy, but we said, let's do them. So we did. And I'm glad we did, of course, because he died only a few years later.
Were you guys, did you remain close? Were you good friends?
We were friends, not particularly close. I mean, Gordon moved to Australia for several years, and, you know, and he had his problems from time to time, so he wasn't always the easiest person to hang out with. But we were friends, you know. We never became enemies, that's for sure, which most duos actually do. We never had any giant fights. We never got sued each other or any of the things that seem so prevalent in duo world.
Well, no, you're very active this year, touring, performing with Jeremy Clyde. You have a lot of dates coming up.
I'm doing some with Jeremy. I've been doing a lot of the memoir show as well. I've probably done more of those, but I am looking forward to going out with Jeremy in the next couple of weeks. I've got about 2 weeks of Jeremy shows, I think.
And how do you get on with him? Are you guys good friends?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've always got on. And that's why it seemed kind of obvious, you know, because Gordon having died 10 or 11 years ago, and then when Chad retired, you know, Jeremy and I, who are both actors and both enjoy being on stage and talking, and of course, I've never had the opportunity to sing Summer Song or Yesterday's Gone any more than he's had the opportunity to sing World Without Love or Nobody I Know. So we kind of went, what the hell? It appears to be destined to happen since they both retired.
And Jeremy's
the low part and I'm the high part. And there's so many weird coincidences anyway. I mean, if you think about it, one of the odder things that doesn't always strike people, in both duos, the lead singer was credited second, which is odd. It was Peter and Gordon and Chad and Jeremy. And Jeremy and Gordon were, of course, the lead singers.
The songs that they recorded and the songs that you recorded, I mean, they're kind of similar in theme, your hits. I mean, World Without Love and Yesterday's Gone, those are kind of similar heartbreak songs.
I suppose. I hadn't thought of it. I mean, obviously, we didn't write World Without Love, so the theme was not ours. But, yeah, I suppose so.
Do you ever perform any of Chad and Jeremy's psychedelic stuff of Cabbages and Kings or anything?
No, he does sometimes. I mean, I like that record, but Jeremy does a show of his own when he does some of those songs.
And you are also doing some gigs with Albert Lee.
Yeah. Those are different because that's the no video show. It's just the two of us with acoustic guitars, and I get to play rhythm guitar for Albert, you know, which is exciting because I get to hear him play every night because he's one of my heroes. Guitar wise. And of course, that we talk a lot about the things we have in common. Like to say, you know, I was a big Everly's fan, and of course, he got to play with him for years. And I was a big Buddy Holly fan, and Albert was a cricket, so there's a lot of overlapping there.
Isn't that crazy? Wow. And you do a one man show, sort of, your memoir show?
Well, that's the memoir one I'm saying. Yeah, I'm doing, you know, I do that quite often. That's probably the one I do the most.
Is that fun to do?
Yes.
Yeah, do people ask questions from the audience, or how does that work?
Sometimes I encourage that. I'm fine with any questions or heckling. Now that same thing applies. Now I've been doing a lot of book signings and readings and stuff, you know, and same thing applies. I'm happy to answer questions.
You know, this book, The Beatles from A to Z, An Alphabetical Mystery Tour, I read it from cover to cover, and now I find myself going back to it quite a bit.
Oh, good. Thanks. That's good.
It's such a great book, and it's got so many laughs. It's a very funny book.
Good. That's good.
And the author is Peter Asher, and my guest. Peter Asher, thanks again for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's a pleasure. No, I enjoyed it very much. Good to talk to you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.